Accession number 28671, Mr. Ronald Wheatman, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about your time with number 14 ITW at Bridlington from September 42 through to October 42. Yeah. Just looking at the basic training you went through. Now, you mentioned the food, and that is something that we could just perhaps drop in now. What was the food like?
The food was excellent, although it was mass-produced and you queued up. But, you see, as young people, you were ravenous. And even though it might, in present-day food, it was very horrible, but you ate it. And the amount of volume that you got for meals, it was there, whether you wanted Rice Krispies or cornflakes beforehand, and always there was a different meal for breakfast every time. It was fish, finny haddock, or bacon and egg, or boiled eggs, and all the rest of it. And the actual meals at lunchtime were good. Everything was good, because I realised that as an aircrew, the country revered you, and you got a lot extra from the ordinary person who was training, as my friends used to, when I wrote to them, and they say, perhaps in army camp, say, our food's bloody awful, can I eat it, it's foul. But I couldn't say that at all, because it was excellent, absolutely excellent.
Now, that what we've covered so far is basic training, a lot of it, you know, yeah. which any airman any soldier would go through. Now, what about some of the specialist things you mentioned? You mentioned map reading.
Yes, you had to learn to read maps. You had to learn to understand navigation, wind drift, and all the rest of it that comes into it of movements through the air. Because as aircrew, you weren't just specifically engaged in air gunner's work as it was at the 14 ITW. You had to learn, you didn't learn anything regarding piloting, but navigation had to come into it, and bomb aiming and all the rest of it. Because
let's talk about the navigation first. How far did you go with navigation?
But navigation was
at this stage. I'm in at Bridlington.
Yeah, there you were 3 weeks on a sort of maths procedure course of learning to steer an aircraft by the stars, by just something you couldn't see, but if you got wind drifts and everything, you were able to produce to the instructor that you could logically get an aircraft to go from point A to point B.
Now, so that's navigation. The second thing you mentioned was Morse code.
Now Morse code, of course. I never had anything to do with Morse code till I went in the RAF, but it seemed to come second nature to me. Now, some people could not master it, and at the same time that you learn Morse code, you learn to tap it out, of course. And you also learned by the visual method of lamps, which the Royal Navy uses, of course. You had to do that as well. And always on the beaches at Bridlington, you went in twos. And you had a newspaper in front of you. And you signaled to someone standing 50 yards or 100 yards away what was on that paper. And you... we were doing it with the flashing light. With the Morse code in the buildings, of course, the instructor tapped something out and the whole class had to listen to it and write down what it was. And your pass out on that was about, I think it was about 6%. It was pretty low, but it was low because they must have found that the ordinary individual could not absorb somehow high pressures of noise with Morse code, but you had to learn it.
So you learned that. Now, what other things? You mentioned a bomb aiming. How far did you go into bomb aiming?
Well, but bomb aiming, now, that was a precision thing in a huge hangar we had, and you were lying on your...
Is this still at Bridlington?
This was at Bridlington, yes, and that was about, I think, it was about 4 days on that, because they couldn't take a long time over it, because it was realised that it was a secondary sort of job to you if the bomber was, you know, was hurt and had to be dragged out, that you had to take over. But you had to learn the basicness of looking at instruments, of lining 2 points up in front of you, which was so simple, but to line these up was solely giving instruction to the pilot, where he had to be under your control, so you had to know, you had to get those intersecting, or this, that, and the other, else the whole thing was a fiasco.
So that's bomb aiming. Now, also you mentioned gunnery. I mean, this is from a turret. And also you mentioned, what do you call it? We fire at...
dogs?
No, the discs.
Clay pigeon. Yeah.
How did they start you with training as a gunner?
Well, with clay pigeon shooting, that was fantastic. I found that I loved that, because you knew exactly the trajectory path of the disc that was flying through the air. And lots of people didn't, first of all, they'd fire, and of course they never had a hit at all, because they're behind the thing, they wouldn't project that it was moving.
So they weren't allowing for deflection shooting?
No, none whatsoever. There was no angle of pursuit, no nothing. So they'd fire rounds off, nothing would happen. And they'd say, well, that disc is... It's a wonderful thing, how we misfit. But when the instructor pointed out, you must fire ahead of the thing, whereas by the time your bullet arrives at that point, it's connected with it. And that was it. Yep.
And you took to that?
Pardon?
You took to it once you've got the hang of it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah.
Now, what was the next stage of shooting? I mean, did they have mock-up? You mentioned a mock-up turret. Was that a Bridlington?
Yes, they had... They had several types of turret there, because there was a lot of different types. There were Fraser Nass, Broughton Paul, and I forget the others now. But at any rate, they're all different. Some of them were 2 guns, some of them were 4. The round one was the Broughton Paul, which was a squat sort of turret. It had a lot of room in it, but it was very quick, and its trajected movement round. But you see, when you're in the mid upper turret, the actual parts at the back, the turret would cease to fire. It was all interlocked, because you'd have blown the bloody tail off of the aircraft, of course. So you had to learn fast the angle where it would come up if something was attacking you from the rear, that it would cease, and then the aircraft would pull away, or it would shoot you down, etc. But firing from a turret was extremely difficult to start with.
Why?
Because you were in a confined area. In a confined area, the stink of cordite was dreadful. And of course, bullets, when they're put into, when they're traversing into the sort of gun part, and they're coming up out of the in and by the side of you, they very often got crossed, and then you had the stop thing would stop firing, and you had to re-cock, pull the damn thing back, and find out what the hell had happened. Now, this all happening, if you were in the air, you realised that if you didn't do it bloody quick, the whole aircraft would be shot down. So you had to be so fast in anything that took place, a stoppage of any sort, and there was a hell of a lot of
them. Now, what were the guns in these mock-up turrets? They weren't Bren. Would they be the Browning?
No, there were 303s.
Browning?
Yeah.
And what did you think of the Browning?
I thought it was very good indeed. I really did. But, of course, like everything else, its distance wasn't very big. You know, when you've got an aircraft coming in at you at 400 miles an hour, or plus that, and you are at the rear of an aircraft, the actual movement of everything is so enormous that to get any shot in at a fighter aircraft, I used to think it was a bloody miracle. I don't know how they
now,
did
it. At this stage, you're just firing from mock-up turrets on the ground,
that's
are you?
That's right, yes, and that's all. And no movement in front of you.
What were you firing at? Fixed targets?
Just fixed targets, yes, that was all. And they did usually have running targets along in the shape of rabbits or something stupid like that.
And you were learning how to strip
had to do that. Was most essential. That was the most essential part of anything regarding gunnery work. You had to know if there was a stoppage of all sorts. You had to scream out straight away to your pilot. Because they were all in numbers. I have a number one stoppage, a number two, and a three, or a four. In definition, a priority. And that you screamed out, you recocked, and you find what it was. Now, the problem was you had to wear sort of gloves. Now, frigging about with machinery with gloves on is one hell of a problem. Your fingers have got to be so sensitive. The gloves that we had were very fine ones, like nylon.
So this is getting into when you're upstairs, isn't it? I mean, we'll come back to that.
Yep.
So very important to know all the different methods of clearing all the different gun
stoppages. That's right. Yeah.
And this would prove difficult when you had to do it in real life in the freezing cold with gloves.
It's extremely difficult.
Now, anything else you did with gunnery learning on the ground at Bridlington?
No.
Now, what about aircraft identification? I know you were you must have been an expert by then.
Aircraft identification, I revelled in, because that was being your feature in the observer corps, and lots of people had no idea what a bloody aircraft was. It's plan view or head on or tail, and also the sit of an aircraft in the air. Every aircraft sits different. And the angle, the sun shining on them, produces all sorts of strange sort of movements, and also presents a totally different shape of the aircraft. And this on these films that we had, and I revelled in it. My scoring was very, very high on that.
How did they test you on it? I mean, how was it done?
Well, what you had, you see, you had screens, and it came on, and came on very quick indeed, and you had to analyse and identify what that aircraft was. Now, it wasn't just German, it was in Italian, it was American, because they were all in the combat zone, of course. So you had to know exactly what that aircraft was. This presented a load of trouble to some of my friends. It really did. You say to me, how the bloody hell do you do it? Well, it's only by what I would call experience, which is all the time the motto of everything. By experience, by gaining knowledge, you can achieve something.
And that was your experience in the observer corps you well.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, any other training that you did at during this, very busy 6 or 7 weeks Bridlington?
Yes, you had to jump off the sea wall into waters and swim.
It's a swimming test?
Yes, yes.
Now tell me about that.
Well, you were in fully clothed with shoes, and the instructor would go along behind you, right, jump, 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 and you just jumped in one after the other into 20 or 30 feet of water, which was foul stuff.
In
the harbour. It was foul. And you just jumped in, you went below, you came with spluttering, and you dog paddled to a boat that was there, of course. But there were loud cheers when somebody sort of finally came up and said, I'm bloody dying, or something like that. He swallowed gallonage of foul water, etc. But you just had to do it, and that was it.
Now, how did you get on with the instructors there? You started to tell me. What did you think of them? You seem to be saying that some of the shouting was counterproductive. What did you think?
Because I found that they had the job of work to do to start with, and they had to be very vicious, because being vicious, they made you think. That was the whole point, being noisy and shouting. They couldn't They wouldn't make your mind rest by shouting stupid fools or some horrible other language, and it just went on and on. And this, you did think of something, God, he's a fatherless type or something like that. But you after a while, you got used to all the shouting and barking and this, that and the other, but you did achieve something. That was the whole secret of being an instructor. And at the end, when we passed out, all the instructors, we used to collect for them, even though we'd hated them, like that man. But we realized after the 6 weeks that what they'd done was to made us legitimately into men from young boys.
Now, did you go out into town? I mean, did you drink? Would you go into town for a drink?
Yes, or? Well, you had a lot of money, of course. As air crew,
you hadn't a lot of money.
No, as air crew, you did receive... my paybook is somewhere, I can't remember, though. But you did receive a certain amount more money than the ordinary individual. That was classified, that you were achieving a sort of status in life.
Even before you qualified?
Yes, even before you qualified, it was there. It wasn't a lot, it was perhaps sixpence and ninepence a day, which to now is stupid, but in then those days it wasn't. Now, the actual brilliant itself was a mass of RAF. The local people treated us splendid.
Tell us about that. How did you get on with them?
The all houses used to send out invites to anyone who wished, if they were off on a Saturday and Sunday, to go and have tea or lunch or dinner at somebody's house. It was magnificent. But this wasn't just at Bridlington, this was all over the country. I found that the people were perfect. Whether it was just to aircrew, I don't know, but it was a godsend. Because it made you realise that you weren't living under dreadful primitive conditions, and those people used to rustle up meals. I don't know how the hell they did it, but it was good. And we were so thankful.
Now, what about, did you go drinking to pubs or?
No,
you weren't a drinker?
No.
Now, anything else about Bridlington? I know you weren't there long, but I mean,
no.
But
well,
anything
it was
else?
A very highly concentrated course. Now,
how were you assessed at the end of it?
You were assessed, on the different things on Morse code, on identification of aircraft, on your general aptitude in life. Because that was, you see, because when you were leaving there, you were going to become an NCO. You were going to become a sergeant. So you had to have an aptitude which you were to other people who were an AC1 or AC2, that they looked to you to give some inspiration to them. So that was fantastic. That had to be, your aptitude had to be, well, not I would say highly professional, but it had to be something about you which projected your image to those people below you. So that was vital, vital.
What else were they assessing?
They were assessing you on one thing that was that your general appearance. When I mean your general appearance, you see, you had to have your shoes polished, you had to have your clothes creased, and you had to have, every week, of course, you had your new laundry, and that was done all the time. But some people, even in aircrew, I know some of them, were not very nice to themselves. Their hygiene was poor. And so,
now what about assessment of your abilities in the courses you were going through? Was that checked?
That was checked all the time, yes. And of course, you got a figure coming through day by day. See, people themselves, day by day, you don't work perfect day by day. You have days when you're down. The next day you can soar up. So it becomes a positive and negative all the time. And that was assessed with you. And if people failed to reach these, they would just say, I'm sorry, you'll have to leave us and go into another trade, etc.
Now, were there actually a final exam, or was it all continuous assessment?
No, there was a final exam which you had to have, and that was very rigid indeed, very rigid. And it lasted all day, from 9 a.m. in the morning. But at the end of it, the beauty of it was that about 9 o'clock at night, you were assembled in one of the halls which was taken over, and your name was called out, and your actual marks that you had received were given, so that everybody listened, everybody knew that Ron Wheatman had achieved so-and-so, or Joe Smith, and everybody knew. And they all congratulated one another, because we knew then we were on to the next phase.
And so you finished that in October?
Yes.
Anything before we leave Bridlington, although we've done a fair bit about Bridlington?
Well, I finished then. It would be about November when I finished.
November, right. So that's
because fine. I had a calamitous thing when I was there.
Tell us about that.
Yes. My father, I got telegrams from the police at Milnthorpe to say my father was dying. I wasn't allowed to leave until a personal message came through from the sergeant on the space that it's imperative that Ronald Wheatman returns home, or his father will have died before he gets here.
Now, and what had happened to your father? What was wrong with him?
He had some stoppage or something in his tummy, and this had caused him to, he couldn't live. And of course, I was released for 48 hours. And of course, I travelled from Bridlington, and I came to Milnthorpe Station. I got off the train there in the early hours of the morning, at 4:45 in the morning, and I walked down to where my father and mother lived. And when I got there, of course, I could see that the curtains in the front room where he was were drawn. I thought, well, he must be sleeping. Of course, when I got in, he died. So I immediately sent up a telegram asking for further time. I was granted another 48 hours, so I was allowed 4 days, and then returned. So,
and this was what? October 42.
This is in 42, yeah.
Now, so that obviously set you back a bit.
It did. It was it, but you see, the peculiar thing about aircrew is, all the time they were very rigid, that you had to steel yourself for anything happening to you, no matter what it was—a loss of a limb, loss of an eye, a loss of something, that you had to realise that some horrible thing could happen to you. And that, I would say, all my life has happened to anything that I've come across, when it's dead people on the road or dead people in jungles. It was there from that word go that you steel yourself, you don't give way. That person's dead or is dying, or you try to help them, but you've not to be compassionate. And that was one thing that was really drilled into you as a member of air crew.
Now, what happened when you left Bridlington in November 1942?
Yes. I went from there to number one air gunner school.
And where was that?
That was at Pembrey in South Wales.
Pembrey
in South Wales.
Pembrey.
P-M-B-R-E-Y. Pembrey.
Now, what was it like when you got there?
Well, that place was as different again. It wasn't as severe as ITW. But you then had to go. It was Blenheim Force that we flew in there.
Now, you hadn't been in aircraft up to this point.
No. You were taken upon. When you got there, within 24 hours, you were put into various sections of 16. And so you kept in that section. There was a sergeant in charge of you. And you then were allocated on trips in Blenheims. There were three at a time, and you went out targets with drogues being pulled by a Lysander.
Now, did you do an air experience flight first before you did the
yes
thing?
You see, when you've never flown, the peculiarity of flying is that you can't understand once you get up from the ground. You sort of You're in an area which is not there. You've nothing below you. You've just nothing. You're just depending on the engine themselves to project you forward. So it's a peculiar sensation, and it happens to everyone who first of all flies. But it only happens to would only happen in those days when it was piston aircraft, because the vibration of aircraft piston is very noisy. The oscillation of everything all the time is noise. So it has a peculiar effect upon you. You have to overcome that.
So you went up, your air experience flight was in a Blenheim?
Yes.
What do you remember of it? Anything other than the...
Yeah, well, of course, we were told that you would become mystified. You weren't asked to do anything, just to sit. And when you came back, it was only a flight of about 40 minutes or something like that. But it was air experience. And then you had to write down what your thoughts had been. And your thoughts were sometimes peculiar. They revolved sometimes around religion. That you'd reached a point whereby you weren't a human being. You were suspended in air. And it was a very weird sensation. It only happens that one time. Never again.
Now, where were you living at Pembrey?
I'm not sure
where it is. It's South Wales.
It's South Wales, yes. Now, this was the Drome itself, and there'd be about 350 was training there as straight air gunners.
And it's number one air gunner school.
That's right.
Were you in huts, or what was your accommodation?
Oh, yes, in huts. There were 16 of us in a hut.
And what was the hut like?
The hut was very comfortable indeed, different again from living in quarters in Bridlington, where you were cramped. You had proper lockers, you had carpets on the floor, because again you realise that the respect in life was towards you, that you were being made to feel that you were someone. And that really hit you straight away, because whatever you did, you see, you wore a white part in your cap, which stood out amongst the other people, that you were not elite, but you were training aircrew.
Now, how did your training start? You've done the air experience flight, so how you trained as a gunner. How did they start you?
Well, you started off then that you had to, three at a time, and you went up in the turret. Now, you were allowed 200 rounds each to fire at targets, which were pulled by some other aircraft, Hawker Henley or a Lysander. They dragged these drogues either starboard of you or underneath you to fire at various angles.
Now, what sort of turret was the Blenheim turret? That rear bolt and pull, would it? Or?
No, it wasn't.
I'm not sure.
I can't remember what the Blenheim... I can't remember. I honestly can't.
Now, what was it like firing at these air drogues?
Well, you thought you'd hit the damn turrets, and you were lucky if you got one bullet in the turret. Now, all the bullets that you had were coloured, so that there was no shooting the whole lot up or something ridiculous like that. But if there were three trainees, they were painted green, blue or red, so that if they went in the turret, there was a blue or green.
You mean in the drogue,
yeah.
And how did you do it first? Badly then, from the sound of it?
Extremely badly. Nobody had a hit. We used to say, how the hell have we missed? But of course, the drogue was bucking up and down like the devil. So you had to really work like the devil to judge the course, the actual speed of the target and everything. And that came into the pass out. This may seem ridiculous to you. The pass out of 200 was 5 in a drogue. 5 only out of 200. That was the pass out. Some didn't achieve that, and if they didn't achieve that, they didn't go forward. It was as simple as that.